in its own way. But in essence, Jerry Hendley had told him to go to his room and think about what he'd done. Christ, Jack thought. He realized, slightly stunned, that he was angry. He understood why Jerry had made the call, but that wasn't the same as acceptance, was it? Had he been fooling himself for the past 5 months? Had he come to peace with the suspension? Or was that simply what he'd told himself he should feel? He didn't know, and didn't feel like thinking about it. "Got any stock tips?" Butler asked. "Depends on what you're looking for, legal or illegal." "Better give the first one." "Good. It's the only kind I know." Jack took another swig and thought about it. "Buy low, sell high." Butler grinned. "Dick. I know a few good private investment managers, if you're looking." "Yeah, maybe, thanks. Another 8 and I'm out. Unless I win the lottery or become the next Wambaugh, I'm gonna need something." They stood there, sipping their beers and saying nothing for a bit. Jack wondered if Butler was using the silence as an interview tool. "My grandfather was a cop," Jack said. "Yeah? Baltimore homicide." Butler nodded slowly. "Mine too. Tulsa. Small world." "What got you into it?" "I was military police in the Army. In May of 03, I ended up in Baghdad. A month after I got there, we got mortared and I took some shrapnel. Spent about 6 months at Walter Reed, then they cut me loose. Alexandria was hiring cops and I figured it would be an easy transition."
"Was it?"
"Mostly. If I'd stayed in, probably not. I know guys that did tour after tour. Those are the ones that have trouble." The silence hung in the air. "So," Jack said, hoping to nudge Butler toward the point of his visit. It worked. "So, are you in some kind of trouble, Jack?"
"You mean aside from last night?"
"Yeah."
"Not that I know of," Jack replied. "Why?"
"About a week ago, a guy was killed on the 395 up near Holmes Run Trail."
"I read about it. Carjacking went bad, wasn't it?"
"Probably. The thing is, the guy lived in this building. He parked in the same garage as you do, drove a black sedan a lot like your Chrysler, and he was a fair match for your description."
Jack felt his belly tighten.
"You're serious?"
"As a heart attack.
The tire on his car blew out. He pulled over to the side of the road to put the spare on. As far as we can figure it, somebody stopped, maybe offered to help him, then slit his throat and left."
Jack didn't reply.
"What I'm wondering now," Butler said, "is if somebody did something to his tire, then followed along and waited until it blew."
"What time was this?"
"About 2 in the morning. He was coming home from his girlfriend's house, just like he did almost every Monday, Tuesday, and Friday for the past 6 months."
"Just as he'd done with the gym," Jack thought.
"Shit," he muttered.
It was all he could think to say.
"That's one word for it," Butler replied. "You didn't answer my question. Are you in trouble?"
"Yes, I think I am."
They'd come at him twice and missed twice, leaving an innocent guy lying on the side of the road with his throat open. If he gave them a third chance, they'd make damn sure he was dead. What was this about? Jack had never put much stock in his status as first son. It was a shadow cast by his father, albeit an unintentional one. Plus, he didn't like the exalted sound of it all. That aside, the truth remained. Somebody was doing their level best to kill the son of the President of the United States. That took a pair of jumbo balls. What could be that important? Not just good old-fashioned revenge, Jack thought. Yegor Moritzov and the people in his circle were dispassionate and logical when it came to violence, ticking boxes and weighing pros and cons before ordering a trigger pulled. Maybe it's gambling or sex, that kind of thing, Butler said.
No, nothing like that.
I'm not looking to hassle you. Even if I was that guy, shaking you down would be more trouble than it's worth, you know? If you've gotten into something over your head, maybe I can help. Don't get me wrong, it's not like you'd be hurting for help if you needed it. CIA, FBI, Department of Agriculture. But if you want to talk...
No, I appreciate it, Detective, but...
Doug.
You sure?
Jack nodded.
Did this guy have family?
Mark's his name. Mother, father, and two sisters. They own a chain of specialty bread shops, McClune's. Anyway, Mark was the heir apparent. It's somebody else's case, so I don't know if there's anything shady on the business side. Listen, Jack, this could be all coincidence. It happens more times than you'd think. Just keep an eye out, yeah?
I will.
Might as well keep that Glock handy, too.
Jack nodded.
Anything more on my guy from last night? Witnesses? Did anyone come forward to claim the body? How about an autopsy?
No and no.
As for an autopsy, there really wasn't much left to cut on. I'm sure the ME will run a tox screen and his fingerprints, but that's about it. Chances are, unless some next of kin show up, he'll end up a guest of the city.
What's that mean?
In the city cemetery. After a month, unidentified bodies are classified as destitute. The taxpayers foot the funeral bill. Anyway, Butler downed the rest of the beer and set it on the counter.
Thanks for that.
Gotta run.
Thanks for stopping by.
Yep. And Jack, one more thing. Maybe think about calling that Secret Service detail, huh? At least for the near future.
Chapter 6. Alexandria, Virginia.
For the second morning in a row, Jack awoke before dawn. He'd slept in fits and starts, glancing at the clock and getting up to stare out the window before lying back down and trying again. He was restless, and there was no outlet for it, no action to take. Somebody was hunting him. The first time, his survival had depended on mistaken identity. The second, the luck of the roll. Tumbling down that slope with Weber, it could just as easily have been Jack's head that had smacked into the concrete barrier. Weber would have had no trouble finishing him off. Pure chaos and chance. Short of waiting for them to try again, Jack had one card left to play, and it was at best a long shot. Assuming the mystery man was Weber's accomplice, the man would have three options. Leave the area, make another try for Jack, or tidy up, then go to ground. Jack was counting on option three. They knew he'd survived. They would assume he now knew about both attempts on his life. They would assume Jack had reported this to the Secret Service. They would assume the full investigative might of the federal government was being mustered. With Weber gone and an untraceable John Doe in the morgue, there was only one fragile investigative thread left to pluck: Weber's belongings at the motel. If anyone was coming to collect these, it would be Weber's accomplice. After stocking up on food and water and a few paperback mysteries from his Wanna Read shelf, Jack drove back to Springfield and used another item from his rucksack, a fake driver's license, to check into the Motel 6. Citing a very special anniversary with his soon-to-arrive girlfriend, Jack asked for room 144. The vaguely goth, nerdy teenage girl behind the reception desk gave him a sotto voce, "Whatever, dude, have fun," and handed him the key card. Jack drove back to the side exit, parked, and went inside. At the door to room 142, he paused to listen. The privacy please placard was still in place. Hearing nothing, he swiped the key card and went inside and made a quick inspection. The room was unchanged. He left and entered the room next door and settled in. Jack's gambit depended largely on the accomplice. Why he'd failed to intervene on Weber's behalf was a mystery. Had he gotten spooked? It was possible. If so, how likely was it that kind of man would show up to collect Weber's belongings? Maybe, if the decision wasn't his to make. Jack had found nothing of use in the room. Perhaps there was nothing of use to find. Did the accomplice, or whoever was pulling his strings, know this? The morning passed slowly. Jack, afraid he'd miss hearing the double beep of Weber's door lock, had assembled a reading nook of bedpillows on the hallway floor. The maids and their squeaky-wheeled carts slowly but steadily made their rounds, tapping on doors and softly calling, "Housekeeping," before either stopping to clean or moving on to the next room. Out of boredom, Jack timed them. They averaged 12 minutes per room. Was this good, bad, or average, he wondered. Finally, one of the maids reached his door. "Housekeeping, do you need anything? Clean towels or soap?" Jack didn't answer. His privacy please placard was in place. Did management make them ask anyway just to cover their bases? Maybe the maids got a secret thrill from interrupting the occasional carnal union. The job was probably boring. You took fun where you found it. After 5 seconds, the maid and her cart continued down the hallway. By mid-afternoon, he'd finished one novel and started a second. He alternately dozed, snacked on trail mix, and drank bottled water. There was a better-than-average chance he was wasting his time here. But he had nothing else, no other lead. Perhaps it was time to call Jerry, maybe Clark. Bringing his dad, and thereby the FBI and the Secret Service, into the loop would create more problems than it would solve, especially for the campus. Sunset came, and then faded into night. Shortly after 9, Jack's eyes fluttered open. He reached for the Glock beside his leg. He'd heard a double beep. Or had he? From where? He rolled to one side and pressed his ear to the wall in time to hear the door to room 142 click shut. I'll be damned. For a full minute, there was only silence. Then a voice, male and heavily muffled through the wall. Jack couldn't make out any words. He crawled into the bathroom, grabbed a glass off the sink, then crawled back. Did this work anywhere outside of the movies? He wondered. He felt idiotic. He pressed the rim against the wall, then his ear to the bottom. The sound was no better. He moved the glass a few inches left, tried again. The voice, though still faint, was clearer. Don't know. Nothing that I can see. The man sounded agitated, hesitant. Clothes? Toiletries? A suitcase? Yes, okay. I will. Something banged against the wall beside Jack's head. He jerked away, then thought, closet. It was on the other side of the wall. Collecting Weber's suitcase? He wondered. Jack stood up, put on his jacket, grabbed his duffel, then holstered the Glock and slipped out of the room. Which way? Whoever was inside Weber's room had come in either through the lobby or through the same side entrance Jack had used. Jack flipped a mental coin and chose the latter. Once outside, he headed for his car, scanning the parking spots as he went. In the fifth stall was a white late-model Nissan Altima. As he passed the trunk, he ducked into a crouch. He took out his cell phone, snapped a picture of the license plate, then stood up and walked the remaining distance to his car. 5 minutes later, a man emerged from the side exit. In the glow of the sconce, Jack caught a glimpse of thinning gray hair and jowls. Jack judged him to be in his mid-50s. The man was gone, heading toward the Nissan, pulling Weber's black suitcase behind him. A minute later, the car backed out of the stall, turned, and headed for the lot's exit. With his headlights off, Jack followed at a distance until the Nissan turned east onto Springfield Boulevard, then sped to the stop sign. He waited until another car had passed, then turned on his headlights and followed.
Chapter 7. Alexandria, Virginia. The Nissan headed east, away from Springfield and up 495, then took the South Van Dorn exit south. At Franconia, the Nissan turned again and once more headed east. Is he dry cleaning? Looking for tails? Jack wondered. Another 10 minutes of driving brought Jack to the Rose Hill area, where the Nissan turned into a residential area. Finally, on Climb Hill Road, the Nissan slowed and pulled into the driveway of a Rambler with sage green paint, white shutters, and a line of squared-off yew bushes bracketing the front steps. A lone porch light burned beside the door. Across the street, instead of houses, there was a park with playground equipment. As Jack drove past the house, he glanced out the side window and saw the Nissan disappearing into a detached garage. Jack continued to the end of the block, then pulled to the curb and shut off his lights. The man's destination was confusing. Rose Hill was a well-established, lower-to-middle-class neighborhood of single-family homes, parks, and elementary schools. How did Eric Weber, the man who'd butchered Mark McClune on the side of a highway and then tried to do the same to him in a grocery store parking lot, cross paths with the man behind the wheel of the Nissan? Hell, not just cross paths. Conspired a murder. Make a decision, Jack. He couldn't sit here for long and risk a visit from the police. Any cop who regularly patrolled the neighborhood would immediately pick out his Chrysler as an anomaly. He had the plate number and the house address. With his Enquester access, those were enough to get a name. But he wanted more. He checked his watch. 5 minutes. It was worth the risk, he decided. He dug into his duffel, grabbed the items he needed, then made sure the car's dome light was off and climbed out. Keeping a slow but purposeful pace that he hoped gave off an I belong vibe, Jack walked back down the block. As he drew even with the house, he turned left off the sidewalk and followed a line of overgrown shrubs down the side of the house and into the backyard. To his left sat a gray, dilapidated shed, the kind you buy as a kit at a home improvement warehouse. To his right were the rear of the house and a raised wooden deck abutting a door. A window to the right of the deck was lit. Kitchen, Jack guessed. Directly across the lawn from him stood the garage. There was a side door, its upper half mullioned glass. Sitting beside the garage's wall was a redwood picnic table. Jack returned his attention to the lighted window. There was no movement. Don't think. Just walk. Jack stood up and trotted across the lawn, eyes alternating between the lighted window and the deck's sliding doors. When he reached the garage, he crouched down and put on his gloves. He tried the door. It was locked, but the knob looked ancient and on its last legs. Jack pulled out his multi-tool, levered open the flathead screwdriver, and slipped it into the keyhole up to the haft. Simultaneously, he slowly turned the tool and the knob in opposite directions. With a clunk, the knob gave way, spinning freely in its socket. Jack eased open the door and slipped inside. He clicked on his red penlight and scanned the interior. It was what Jack expected. Exposed wood walls, cardboard boxes stacked on makeshift rafter shelves, a tool-laden pegboard and cramped workbench tucked against the wall, its drawers almost touching the bumper of the Nissan, whose engine ticked as it cooled in the night air. Jack checked his watch. Almost 2 of his 5 minutes had passed. 2 more for a search, and a minute to get back to his car. Jack made his way to the passenger side, opened the door, then leaned in and switched off the dome light. He popped the glove compartment and sorted through the contents. Owner's manual, insurance card, car registration. The man's name was Peter Hahn. Huh. Another German surname, Jack thought. He photographed the insurance card and registration, then returned everything to the glove compartment. He opened the center console. Inside, along with a few packs of chewing gum, an Altoids tin full of quarters, and a bottle of new car smell air freshener, was a Nokia cell phone. That'll do, Jack whispered. Clearly, Mr. Han was not a technophile who needed his phone nearby at all times. Jack's dad was the same way.
From his pocket, Jack pulled a small canvas case and unzipped it. He sorted through the contents until he found the micro USB adapter, which he slid into the phone's charging port. Into the adapter itself, he plugged his thumb-sized DRS, data recovery stick, a commercial and less versatile version of the tailor-made model as Gavin Beery produced for the campus's personnel. This version would skim only the most basic info from the phone: contacts, text messages, call and browser history, but no DNS, domain name system data that could tell him more about the sites the owner visited and people he emailed. Jack powered up the phone. A light on the DRS started blinking green. When the light flashed red, Jack disconnected and returned the phone to the console. Finally, he planted a GPS tracker, a commercial model about the size of a deck of playing cards, velcroing it around a cable cluster beneath the passenger side dashboard. He gave the car a quick once-over, making sure everything was where and how he'd found it, then eased shut the door and left the garage. From his left side, a flashlight beam blinded him. Cop. He resisted the instinct to reach for his gun. "If you move, I will shoot you," a voice said from the darkness. Jack detected a faint accent, perhaps German. Was this Peter Han? Jack had checked left. The man must have posted himself at the corner of the garage wall and waited. Crafty. Jack took a gamble. "Hey, man, I was just looking for a little cash. I'll put it back, okay? It was just some quarters." "Turn around," Han ordered. His voice was even, without the slightest trace of anxiety. This wasn't the first time the German had held someone at gunpoint. "Come on, just let me go. I won't come back, I swear." "I said turn around." Slowly. Hands out to the side. "Damn it. Rusty, Jack. You've gotten rusty." Slowly, Jack turned around. He squinted against the glare of the flashlight and lowered his head slightly so the brim of his cap would shade his face. He could see nothing of Han behind the beam of his flashlight. Han muttered, "You little assholes. Why don't you just stop?" Jack felt a tinge of relief. Definitely not a cop. "Wait," Han said. "Take off your hat. Let me see your face." "You're done, Jack." He took off his cap. "Look at me," Han ordered. Squinting, Jack turned his face into the light and lifted his chin. There were a few seconds of silence before Han said, "You know, it would make my life much easier if I shot you right here." If Han was surprised to find Jack standing in his backyard, the man betrayed none of it in his voice. "You didn't kill me the other night when you had the chance," Jack replied. "Why do it now?" Han didn't reply. Jack pushed on. "Killing me wouldn't solve your problems. They'd only get worse. I assume you know who I am." Even in this context, the phrase tasted sour in Jack's mouth, but he was arguing for his life. "Yes, I know who you are. Still, it might solve my biggest problem," Han replied. "Good, still talking," Jack thought. "Which is what? Dealing with whoever ordered you to clean out Weber's hotel room?" "You followed me. You and your friend tried to kill me. I want to know why." Again, Han was silent for a moment. "He's not my friend." Jack said, "Mr. Han, can you take the light out of my eyes?" "Lift up your jacket with your left hand and slowly turn around." Jack complied, and Han said, "Remove the gun and place it on the ground in front of you." Jack did so, and Han ordered him to back up and sit down at the picnic table. Han stepped forward, his gun never wavering, and picked up Jack's Glock, stuffed it into his belt, then lowered the flashlight beam to Jack's chest. "I have questions," Han said.
That makes two of us. Why do they want you dead? I was hoping you could tell me. I don't even know who they are. Why did you leave the parking lot? Why didn't you finish me?
Jack's eyes adjusted so he could now see Han's silhouette. In the side glow of the flashlight, he made out a snub-nosed revolver in Han's right hand.
I'm not sure, Han replied. I'm not that kind of man. Not anymore.
I never was, I don't think.
What they were asking, it made no sense. It's just murder.
Were you there when Weber killed that kid on the side of the freeway?
Han exhaled heavily. He lowered the revolver to his side. I tried to tell him he had the wrong person.
Han sounded weary, resigned.
He didn't listen. Such a waste.
Who ordered it?
That I won't answer. As it is, I don't know if I've done enough to save her. I hope so.
Before Jack could ask the logical question, Han added, they'd never made the threat plain, you know.
But I know him. He just might do it.
I might be able to help.
No.
Jack realized Han hadn't asked the obvious question. Why was the son of the President of the United States here in his backyard, rather than the Secret Service or FBI? If Madonna showed up to repossess your car, you'd want to know why her, of all people. Jack suspected Han just didn't care. Whatever mess he'd gotten into had pushed him to his limit.
I can make some calls, Jack said, immediately recognizing the absurdity of the statement. He couldn't begin to explain any of this.
Han chuckled. Calls.
You can make some calls. How nice of you.
No. What's going to happen next is...
Han hesitated, as though searching for the right word.
Necessary.
Jack felt his chest tighten. He kept his eyes on Han's gun hand, waiting. He had little chance of reaching Han in time, but he'd be damned if he was going to be killed sitting at a picnic table. Nor was he going to allow Han to take him anywhere. Secondary locations were graveyards. What Han said next surprised Jack.
Loyalty is an odd thing, isn't it?
Sometimes. Tell me what's going on. I'll do what I can.
Not possible. I can't tell you. But I can point you in the right direction.
What does that mean?
You'll have to do the rest. I assume you have means of following me? Never mind. Of course you do. It will happen soon, in the next day or two. So be ready.
Jack was back at the Aronico 30 minutes later. He'd tried to push Han for further explanation, for anything, but the man had simply laid Jack's Glock on the ground, then turned and walked back into his house. Jack had been so stunned he sat in the darkness for nearly a minute, mind spinning, before returning to his car. Now he grabbed a beer, sat down in front of his laptop, and plugged the DRS stick into the USB port. He waited until the program started downloading Han's cell phone dump, then logged into the Enquester portal and typed in Han's information. The results came back in 10 seconds. Jack scanned them. Peter Han, 63 years old, naturalized citizen, emigrated from Germany 16 years earlier. Retired from Xerox as a facilities maintenance manager 3 years ago. Widowed. One grown child, a daughter. Solid credit rating, mortgage to the Climb Hill house paid off, almost no unsecured debt, no legal judgments, past or pending, and so on. With higher-level access to the campus's system, Jack could have cross-checked both Han and Weber against both Hendley's raw and processed intelligence database. But that wasn't an option. Something told him the search would have turned up nothing substantial anyway. Peter Han was an average guy. No red flags. Aside from every word that had come out of the man's mouth tonight, of course.
And aside from the fact that he'd handled Jack like a man who'd seen his fair share of hairy situations. Jack's laptop beeped, signaling that the DRS had finished downloading. Jack double-clicked the text document. The data dump was a block of plain, unformatted text. Already knowing what he was looking for, Jack was able to quickly separate the data into text messages, phone usage, and web history. Peter Hahn didn't use his phone for text messaging or web browsing, and the call history was brief. Pizza places, theaters, the public library, a man named Larry Bowling Night, and someone named BB. Jack tapped on each of these in turn. The first person, Larry Neal, also lived in Rose Hill, a few blocks from Hahn. The next name, BB, came back with a German address and phone number. Kalmunsterstrasse 61, 81664, München, 011-4989-232-39779. Germany again. That thread was thickening. Had he pissed off someone in Germany? Nothing came to mind. It will happen soon, so be ready, Hahn had said. What will happen? And who is her? Chapter 8. Alexandria, Virginia. Hahn's version of soon was the following afternoon. Jack was again killing time, having spent the morning trying to piece together what he had and watching the rain clouds gather through his balcony window. By noon, a steady drizzle had begun to fall. Jack continued to wrestle with the course he'd chosen. The attempt on his life had to have something to do with the campus. Nothing else made sense. If so, Jerry Hendley deserved to be in the loop, especially if he wasn't the only one who'd been targeted. Isabel was safe, but what about everyone else? He grabbed his phone and speed-dialed John Clark's direct line. Clark answered on the second ring. Hey, Jack, what's cooking? Clark's tone was untroubled. In the field, the man was impossible to read, a poker opponent's worst nightmare. But around the office, as Hendley's director of operations, he wore his feelings plainly enough. If someone was going after anybody at the campus, Jack would have heard it in his voice. Just checking in, making sure everyone's alive and kicking. All is well. If this weren't true, Clark wouldn't have said so outright, but he would have gotten his point across. Besides, if someone had come after Dom or Chavez or anyone else, Jack would have heard about it already. Though he was in exile, he was still part of the Hendley family. Clark asked, "What have you been up to?" The question was a natural one, but Jack couldn't help but feel the absurdity of it. What have I been up to? Busy not getting murdered. Instead, he said, not much. Going to the gym, watching Real Housewives, you know, the usual. Clark chuckled. I record all mine on the DVR. Keeps me up all night. So you're coming back into the fold soon, right? You talked to Jerry yet? No. Still thinking about it. What's there to think about? Jack didn't answer. Clark said, Ding was asking about you. Maybe let's grab a beer next week, okay? Sure, I'll call you. Jack disconnected. The conversation seemed to confirm what he suspected. This was about him specifically, not about the campus as a whole. Shortly after 3, his cell phone beeped. He checked the screen. The accelerometer in the GPS unit had detected movement. Peter Hahn's car was pulling out of the garage, presumably with Hahn inside. The possibility that Jack was being lured, invited was a better word, into a trap had crossed his mind. Either Hahn was trying to lead Jack in the right direction, or he was hoping to finish the job Weber had started. But he hadn't wanted to do it in his own backyard. It didn't matter. This was his only lead. He grabbed his rucksack and headed for the door. Hahn was moving slowly, heading north and west away from Rose Hill. After pulling out of the parking garage, Jack pulled to the curb, stuck his cell phone in the dashboard mount, and synced it to the Chrysler's onboard navigation system. On the bright, bigger screen, the pulsing blue pop was easy to see. Han's car reached Highway 495, where it paused momentarily before merging and heading due west. Unless Han exited soon, the highway would turn north up toward Annandale and Dunloring and Tyson's Corner. Even with Han moving as slowly as he was, Jack couldn't catch up. For now, he'd have to settle for parallel. He made his way to George Washington Memorial Parkway and headed north. Traffic was light, but wouldn't stay that way for long once rush hour started. His car's wipers intermittently squeaked and bumped across the windshield, keeping pace with the light rain. Jack kept one eye on the road and one eye on Han's blip, which was still headed north and approaching Annandale. In his mind's eye, Jack ran through his options, should Han turn west. Once past Arlington Cemetery, he could jump on the Custis Parkway and, he hoped, make up the 8-mile gap before Han got too far ahead. For the next 10 minutes, they both continued north, Han still on the 495, Jack following the GW Parkway along the Potomac River, each angling toward the other. Eventually, the two highways would intersect before crossing the river and turning into the Capitol Beltway. Jack's last chance to make a quick jaunt west, the Georgetown Pike, came and went, and still Han's blip moved steadily north. Jack picked up speed until he was going 80 miles per hour, hoping against hope a passing cop didn't spot him. Han's route would take him straight across the Potomac, while Jack had to follow the loop, costing him almost 4 miles. Jack was halfway there, passing the midpoint of Langley Oaks Park, when the blip slowed and took the Georgetown Pike Loop off-ramp, where it paused. "What's over there?" Jack muttered to himself. To the west lay one of the more expensive residential areas in McLean, where houses ran well into the millions. Jack used his right hand to pan and zoom the car's nav screen. To the west of the 495 was an open expanse. A nature preserve, it looked like. Secluded. And on a day like this, probably empty. The location made sense. For an isolated meeting place. Or for a trap. Or for whatever Peter Han was taking him to see. "Come on," Jack told the blip. "Do something." Jack was now passing Parkview Hills and approaching the Georgetown Pike 495 interchange. Han's car was less than a mile ahead and stopped. The blip turned west onto the pike. Jack sped up and reached the exit turnoff 40 seconds later. Here, west of the 495, the pike was known as Cardinal Drive. On Jack's nav screen, Han's car was a half mile ahead and slowing at Swinks Mill Road. It turned right into what looked like an elongated, winding parking lot. Jack took his foot off the gas pedal and coasted until he reached Swinks Mill. He stopped just short of the preserve entrance and eased ahead until he could see through the trees. Though the temperature was in the low 60s, the rain and wind made for miserable hiking weather, and it was still too early in the season for the die-hard mushroom collectors to be out. He saw no cars before the road curved and disappeared around a bend. This was a damn terrible idea, Jack thought. Tactically, there were many reasons why he shouldn't be doing this, the biggest of which was exfiltration. Once inside this parking lot, he would be boxed with a lone, narrow road for an escape route. And he had no backup. On the other hand, if he took the time to find another entrance and Han left his car, Jack would never find him. No choice. Nothing's perfect. Either you adapt or you fail. He scanned the lot for surveillance cameras, but saw none. He turned in and drove to the lot's rear section, a cul-de-sac roughly 100 yards long. At the far end, Han's Nissan was pulling onto a single-lane dirt access road. Jack grabbed his binoculars from the rucksack and zoomed in. A wooden sign with yellow letters read, "Authorized personnel only." Lying on the ground beside the sign's post was a pile of chain. After a few moments, the car's tail lights disappeared through the trees. Shit. He saw no other cars in the lot. Who was Han meeting? And where? This access road didn't appear on the car's navigation screen. Out his side window was a small roofed kiosk. On its wall, behind plexiglass, were what looked like a collection of enlarged historical photos. The box that should have contained maps was empty. He rolled down both windows a couple inches and pulled ahead, scanning the trees on either side until he reached the entrance access road. Jack's inner warning voice was talking to him. Leave. Call Hindley. Not yet. His gut was also talking to him. Something about Han, about his demeanor that told Jack the man could be trusted. No, trusted was the wrong word. But twice Han had passed up a chance to kill Jack. Whoever was pulling the man's strings, he'd chosen a different path. What that was, Jack didn't know, and he was about to find out which of his two voices was right. Jack drew his Glock and tucked it under his thigh. He eased the nose of the Chrysler between the posts and drove on. Chapter 9. Alexandria, Virginia. The road wound its way north, generally following the course of a creek Jack could hear gurgling through his driver's side window. Occasionally, through the trees, he glimpsed the Nissan's red taillights or the white of its trunk. Han was moving slowly, less than 20 miles an hour. The trees continued to thicken, and soon the road veered slightly right, east, away from the river, and the grade steepened. Ahead, Han's brake lights flashed, then went out. Han had stopped with his passenger side tires on the dirt shoulder. Beyond the car, the access road curved right, following the contour of the Potomac's banks, Jack guessed. Jack coasted to a stop, then put the car in reverse and backed down the road until he could barely see Han's car through the trees. Han got out of his car. He opened a green and white golf umbrella. Without so much as a glance in Jack's direction, he walked across the road, down into the ditch, and disappeared from view. Jack gave him a 30-second head start, then climbed out, pulled the brim of his cap lower over his eyes, and followed. The rain had picked up slightly, and the drops pattered the loam alongside the road. When he drew even with the spot where Han had left the road, Jack saw there was a narrow trail heading north and west as it skirted the base of a rocky hill. If there was high ground to be had, Jack was going to take it. And if someone was lying in wait for him, chances were good that was where they would be. Jack continued down the road another 50 feet until he found a natural break in the trees, then hopped down into the ditch and started up the slope. The leaves were slick underfoot, but by using roots and exposed rock, Jack was able to slowly pick his way upward, stopping occasionally to scan the terrain. Another few minutes of hiking brought him to a shallow cliff face. He picked his way up to a ledge where the rocks formed a natural stairway, then began climbing. Jack paused. Where is Han? The trail he'd taken had to be somewhere to his left and below. He kept climbing until the stairs broadened into a rock shelf covered in scrub trees. He crept ahead until he was a few feet from the far edge, then crouched and peeked over. Below him lay a ravine bisected by the creek. To his left, at the mouth of the ravine, a waterfall plunged into a churning catch basin before emptying into a lagoon, itself spanned by a flagstone ford. Traversing the waterfall was a wooden footbridge. Jack sensed movement to the left. He lay down on his belly and aimed the binoculars in that direction. It was Peter Han's green and white umbrella emerging from the trail. Han reached the bridge and started across. At the halfway point, he stopped. He placed his hand on the railing and leaned forward for a better view of the waterfall. Rain dribbled from the edge of his umbrella. 5 minutes passed. A lone figure wearing a khaki trench coat and carrying a black umbrella mounted the bridge from the opposite side of the ravine and walked toward Han. Jack zoomed in, but at this angle he could see nothing above the man's chest. His gait and build told Jack the man was younger than Han. Han saw Trenchcoat and turned toward him. He extended his hand in greeting. Trenchcoat motioned to do the same. His hand came out of his coat pocket holding a palm-sized semi-automatic pistol.
"What the?"
Jack muttered. He drew his Glock, but too late. The pistol's muzzle flashed orange. In the rush of the waterfall, the shot was silent. Han took a step backward as though someone had punched him in the belly. Trenchcoat fired again. Han's right leg buckled and he fell sideways, back against the handrail, then slid down onto his butt. His umbrella slipped from his hand, bounced off the footbridge's wooden treads, and rolled away. Trenchcoat lifted the pistol and shot Han in the right eye. He shoved the gun into his jacket pocket, turned, and walked away. From the first shot to the coup de grace, less than 5 seconds had elapsed. Jack's natural instinct was to run to Han, but he quashed it. The German was dead without a doubt. Next, run down Han's killer. This too he resisted. Had Han brought him here to witness this, or to find the next link in the chain? Or both? Whatever the answer, it lay with the man walking back across the bridge. Jack raised the binoculars and tracked him. Trenchcoat's pace was unhurried, as if he were out for a casual nature walk. At the foot of the bridge, he turned right onto a trail, and Jack lost sight of him behind the trees. Jack stood up and crouch walked to the far edge of the rock shelf, then lay down again and started scanning with the binoculars. According to his car's nav screen, this preserve's border was marked by the creek below, which meant Trenchcoat had parked somewhere within the preserve, farther down the access road, or somewhere in the residential areas to the west. This seemed less likely, he judged, given the exclusivity of this area of McLean. A non-native vehicle in a well-to-do and tight-knit neighborhood would quickly attract attention. How much time did he give Trenchcoat? Jack wondered. 90 seconds, he decided. He started counting and focused the binoculars on the lagoon's flagstone pads. When Jack's count reached 40, Trenchcoat emerged from the screen of trees and stepped onto the bank of the lagoon. He started across the ford. Jack zoomed in. Still, the man's face was blocked by the umbrella. Jack backed away from the edge, turned around, and retraced his path, moving as fast and as quietly as possible. When he reached the ditch bordering the road, he stopped and looked left to where he guessed Trenchcoat would emerge. Clear. He sprinted across it and into the trees beyond. He needed to get ahead of Han's killer. After 50 feet, he veered left toward the access road, slowing his pace as he drew closer. When he could see the road's berm through the trees, he stopped and crouched. He raised the binoculars and panned back along the road.
Where are you?
There. Trenchcoat was coming down the road, still strolling without a care in the world. Jack had a lead, but not much of one. He recalled his rough mental map of the preserve. Eventually, this access road would have to curve south before reaching Highway 495 and heading back toward Cardinal Drive. He stood up, backed through the trees until he lost sight of the road, then turned and started moving again, keeping the road on his left. Jack adjusted course to the south, ran for another 60 seconds, then again veered left until the road came back into view. Ahead through the trees, he glimpsed a flash of metallic blue car paint. He crouched beside a stump and lifted the binoculars to his eyes. It was the hood of a mid-sized sedan. He'd found a second parking lot, this one smaller than the first, a horseshoe-shaped clearing with enough spaces for 10 to 15 cars. All but one of them was empty. The access road entered on the left and exited on the right. He zoomed in on the car. It was a Chevy Malibu. On the upper right side of the windshield was a Hertz sticker. Jack panned down and focused on the Maryland license plate. He memorized the number. Jack lowered the binoculars and looked left through the trees, waiting for a glimpse of Trenchcoat. He had two options. intercept the man and snatch him up, or try to gather more information and track him. The former was impractical for a number of reasons, the biggest of which was what to do with the man. Chain him up in the condo's pantry and torture him? No. If he wanted to get to the heart of what was happening and find a way to make it stop, he needed to know who was giving the orders. Still, the idea of watching a murderer get in his car and drive away rankled Jack's conscience. Whatever Han's reasons, it seemed he'd come to this meeting knowing it would probably cost him his life. Moreover, he'd spared Jack's life twice. While Jack felt no particular affection for Han, the least he could do was make that sacrifice count. From Jack's right, he heard the crunch of tires on gravel. He looked that way and saw a red compact SUV pull into the clearing and turn into one of the stalls opposite the Malibu. After a few moments, the SUV's taillights went dark and exhaust stopped flowing from the muffler pipe. The driver's side door opened. Jack scanned left, looking for Trenchcoat. He was 100 feet from the parking lot. Jack felt a shiver of panic. What happened next depended on Trenchcoat's attitude toward witnesses. Would it be worth a second murder to get away from the scene cleanly? The SUV's driver got out, walked around the rear of the vehicle, stopped. He looked left and right, then walked across the lot toward Trenchcoat's Malibu. When he reached the rear bumper, he pulled out a cell phone and snapped a picture of the license plate, then walked to the driver's side window and peered inside. "What are you doing?" Jack muttered to himself. "Who was this? A cop? A thief?" The man struck Jack as neither. He was in his mid-20s, with shaggy blonde hair and a prominent chin, and he moved tentatively, without the confidence of a cop. This wasn't going to end well. The man straightened up and started back toward his SUV. The Malibu's headlights flashed once, accompanied by a muted beep and the clunk of the door locks disengaging. Jack looked left, felt his heart lurch into his throat. Trenchcoat was entering the parking lot, umbrella still covering half his face. His pistol was up and pointed at the SUV's driver. The muzzle flashed. The report was no louder than that of a wet towel being snapped. The SUV's driver crumpled to the ground. "Damn it," Jack thought. Whoever this new person was, bystander or player, he couldn't let Trenchcoat kill him. Jack drew his Glock, stood up, sprinted into the parking lot and took aim on the man. "Freeze!" he shouted. Trenchcoat stopped walking, but his gun never wavered from the fallen SUV driver. Slowly, Trenchcoat turned his head toward Jack. "Put the gun down," Jack called. For a long 3 seconds, the man didn't respond. Jack could see only his chin and mouth below the rim of the umbrella. Trenchcoat said, "This man is still alive." Jack detected no accent. "If you want him to stay that way, you'll lose the gun." Trenchcoat had already killed one man today and had just gunned down a second. If Jack dropped his weapon, he'd be the third, either to silence another witness or because Trenchcoat recognized him for who he was, the target they'd missed twice already. Jack flicked his eyes toward the SUV. He could see the driver's feet poking out from behind the rear tire. One of them moved, scraping the dirt as though the man was trying to crawl away. "No chance," Jack replied. The man stared at Jack for a few seconds, then called to the SUV's driver. "You there, can you hear me?"
"Yes, I can hear you,"
came the faint reply. Now Jack caught the trace of an accent, vaguely European, perhaps German. "Crawl toward me. Do it now, or I'll shoot you again." Jack said, "Stay there." Then to Trenchcoat, "Give it up."
"You're not the police, are you?" the man replied. He sounded mildly surprised.
Trenchcoat was unflappable, Jack realized. He'd done this before, more than a few times. "No, but I'm a decent shot," Jack replied. Put down your gun. Last chance. Trenchcoat didn't bite. Let me leave, and we all live through this. Back up, and I'll get in my car and drive away. You can help this man before he bleeds to death. In reply, Jack stalked forward 3 paces until he was standing at the Malibu's bumper. Slowly he crouched down until only his shoulders and head were exposed. No. I'm taking his car. You have my word, I will not kill him. Bullshit. With his eyes flicking between Jack and the SUV, the man paced forward, gun still trained on the fallen driver. I'll keep my word, Trenchcoat said. I just want to leave. Jack shouted, not another step! In one fluid motion, Trenchcoat ducked and spun, his pistol swinging around. Jack saw the muzzle flash. He felt something pluck at the collar of his jacket beside his ear. He ducked behind the Malibu's engine block, then peeked around the bumper. Fast bastard, Jack thought. Trenchcoat was sprinting toward the SUV, gun coming back around toward the driver. The muzzle flashed. Jack tracked him with the Glock, leading him a bit, then fired. The bullet punched into the wet earth between Trenchcoat and the SUV's rear bumper. Next one's in your chest, Jack shouted. This wasn't true. He needed the man alive, but shooting to wound went against all his training. Trenchcoat kept going. Jack fired again. This time the round struck Trenchcoat's right calf. He stumbled sideways but regained his balance and disappeared behind the SUV. Jack sprinted forward, gun raised, looking for Trenchcoat's silhouette inside the SUV. Get out of the car, Jack shouted. Out of the car! 10 feet from the SUV, he slowed his pace, scanning for movement. He ducked, looked beneath the SUV, but saw nothing but the inert form of the driver. In the distance, he heard the muffled snapping of branches. Jack reached the SUV's bumper and stopped to peek around the edge. Across the road, Trenchcoat was fleeing through the trees. Jack raised his Glock. Late. He had no shot. To his right came a groan. The driver was alive. Can you hear me? Jack asked him.
Yes. Who are you?
Stay still. Don't move. Hold on. I need to be sure he's not doubling back. Jack watched the trees for another 60 seconds, then stood up, sidestepped to the man, and crouched beside him. He was lying on his belly, face turned toward Jack and in the dirt. The hair above his left ear was matted with blood, some of it running down his cheek. The rain diluted it pink.
My head hurts, he told Jack.
I'll bet. Can you see the trees across the road?
Yes.
Watch them, Jack replied. He's out there. Tell me if anything moves. He holstered the Glock and leaned over the man. His blue eyes, wide with fear, were rotated toward Jack. Using his fingertips, Jack probed through the bloody hair until his index finger found a groove in the man's scalp, about 1/8 inch deep and 2 inches long. The man winced.
Am I shot?
Grazed, Jack replied, still probing.
Trenchcoat had fired twice.
Was there another wound?
There's so much blood, the man said.
It's a scalp wound. They're like that. What's your name?
Ephraim.
Jack had a long list of other questions, but they would have to wait. We need to get out of here, Ephraim, Jack said. Can you move?
I think so.
Jack helped Ephraim to a sitting position, his back against the tire, then walked around and opened the rear hatch. Inside the cargo area was a yellow, hard-sided roller suitcase. Jack unzipped it and rummaged around until he found some white tube socks. He tied 3 of them together, end to end, then returned to Ephraim. Hold this against your head, Jack told him. Like that. Jack guided his hand, pressing one of the sock's knots into the wound. He circled the loose ends around Ephraim's skull and cinched the makeshift bandage with a square knot.
My head really hurts, Ephraim repeated.
You're going to be okay. Lift up your shirt.
What?
Jack was already doing it, jerking Ephraim's shirt and jacket up toward his shoulders. Ephraim caught on and helped with his free hand.
Anything?
He asked. Jack could hear the fear in his voice now. The shock was starting to wear off a bit, replaced by the realization of what had just happened. Jack turned him around, scanned his back. He saw no wounds. Ephraim asked,
What about my legs?
If he'd hit an artery, we'd know about it. Trust me. Can you drive? We need to get out of here.
Okay. I think so. Are you the police?
Yell if you see him coming back, Jack replied. He walked back to the Malibu, paused to pick up the Glock's two spent shell casings, then opened the driver's side door. He pressed the trunk release, then walked around and searched it. Empty. He returned to the car and did a rapid search. Glove compartment, center console, under the seats. On the floor of the passenger seat were two balled-up fast food bags, one Arby's and one McDonald's. In each of these was a cash receipt, which he pocketed. Tucked behind the driver's side floor mat next to the gas pedal, he found a burgundy-colored passport bearing Germany's coat-of-arms eagle and the words Europäische Union, Bundesrepublik Deutschland, and Reisepass. The name inside the passport was Stefan Müller. The identification picture showed an early 40s man with short black hair and a thick, hipsterish beard. Jack doubted this was Trenchcoat's real name, but it was a start, another thread he could hopefully unravel.